Lesson 14. Profiting by Failure. You can do it if you believe you can. Ordinarily, failure is a negative term. But in this lesson, the word will be given a new meaning, because it has been a very much misused word, and for that reason, has brought unnecessary grief and hardship to millions of people. I will distinguish between failure and defeat, and you will see if what is so often looked upon as failure is not, in reality, just temporary defeat. Moreover, you will see if this temporary defeat is not usually a blessing in disguise. You will also learn that sound character is often the product of reversals and setbacks. Neither temporary defeat nor adversity amounts to failure in the mind of the person who looks upon it as a teacher of some needed lesson. There is a great and lasting lesson in every reversal and in every defeat, and usually it is a lesson that could be learned in no other way. Defeat often talks to us in a language that we do not understand. If this were not true, we would not make the same mistakes over and over again without profiting by the lessons that they might teach us. If it were not true, we would observe more closely the mistakes that other people make, and we would profit by them also. 7 Turning Points. Perhaps I can best help you to interpret the meaning of defeat by taking you back over some of my own experiences covering a period of approximately 30 years. 7 different times within this period, I have come to the turning point that the uninformed call failure. At each of these 7 turning points, I thought I had been a dismal failure. But now I know what looked to be a failure was nothing more than a kindly, unseen hand that halted me in my chosen course, and with great wisdom, forced me to redirect my efforts along more advantageous pathways. I realized this, however, only after I had taken a retrospective view of my experiences and had analyzed them in the light of many years of meditative thought. 1st Turning Point. After finishing a course at a business college, I took a job as stenographer and bookkeeper, a position that I held for the next 5 years. As a result of having practiced the habit of performing more work and better work than that for which I was paid, as described in Lesson 9, Volume 3, I advanced rapidly until I was assuming responsibilities and receiving a salary far out of proportion to my age. I saved my money, and my bank account amounted to several $1,000s. My reputation spread rapidly and found competitive bidders for my services. To meet these offers from competitors, my employer advanced me to the position of general manager of the mines where I was employed. I was quickly getting on top of the world, and I knew it. Ah, but that was the sad part. I knew it. Then fate reached out and gave me a gentle nudge. My employer lost his fortune, and I lost my position. This was my first real defeat, and even though it came about as the result of causes beyond my control, I didn't learn a lesson from it until many years later. 2nd Turning Point. My next position was that of sales manager for a large lumber manufacturer in the South. I knew nothing about lumber and little about sales management, but I had learned that it was beneficial to render more service than that for which I was paid. I had also learned that it paid to take the initiative and find out what needed to be done without someone telling me to do it. A good-sized bank account, as well as a record of steady advancement in my previous position, gave me all the self-confidence I needed, with perhaps some despair. My advancement was rapid, my salary having been increased twice during the first year. I did so well in the management of sales that my employer took me into partnership with him. We began to make money, and I began to see myself on top of the world again. To stand on top of the world is a wonderful feeling. But it is a very dangerous place to stand, unless one stands very firmly, because the fall is so long and hard if one should stumble. But I was succeeding by leaps and bounds. Up to that time, it had never occurred to me that success could be measured in terms other than money and authority. Perhaps this was due to the fact that I had more money than I needed, and more authority than I could manage safely at that age. Not only was I succeeding, from my viewpoint of success, but I knew I was working in the one and only business suited to my temperament. Nothing could have induced me to change into another line of endeavor. Nothing, that is, except what happened which forced me to change. I strutted around under the influence of my own vanity until I began to feel my importance. In the light of my more mature years, I now wonder if the unseen hand does not purposely permit us foolish human beings to parade ourselves before our own mirrors of vanity until we come to see how vulgarly we are acting, and we become ashamed of ourselves. At any rate, I seemed to have a clear track ahead of me. There was plenty of coal in the bunker, there was water in the tank, and my hand was on the throttle. I opened it wide and sped along at a rapid pace. Alas, fate awaited me just around the corner with a stuffed club that was not stuffed with cotton. Of course, I did not see the impending crash until it came. Mine was a sad story, but not unlike that which many others might tell if they would be frank with themselves. Like a stroke of lightning out of a clear sky, the 1907 panic swept down, and overnight it rendered me an enduring service by destroying our business and relieving me of every dollar that I had. This was my first serious defeat. I mistook it then for failure. But it was not, and before I complete this lesson, I will tell you why it was not. The Editor's Commentary. The panic referred to by Napoleon Hill began in the summer of 1907, when a number of banks and stock brokerages declared bankruptcy. Nervous investors began selling shares, which caused stock prices to drop even further. Investors withdrew money from their banks to cover their losses, but only the largest banks had enough cash reserves to cover the demand. Smaller banks that didn't have enough cash in their vaults had to turn away customers. As word spread to the general public, it created a run on the banks as depositors lined up to demand they be given the money they had on deposit. Banks called in loans to meet the demand for cash. When the borrowers couldn't pay, the banks foreclosed on the businesses, homes, or whatever else had been put up as collateral. America was caught in a downward spiral that was reversed only when the major Wall Street bankers and financial executives, who were themselves in danger of losing their businesses, stepped in to shore up troubled banks. In addition to arranging foreign loans, they themselves bought stocks as a show of faith in the market. It was in large part because of the bank panic of 1907 that legislation was enacted in 1913 to create the Federal Reserve System. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Third turning point. It required the 1907 panic and the defeat that it brought me to divert and redirect my efforts from the lumber business to the study of law. Nothing on earth, except defeat, could have brought about this result. Thus, the third turning point of my life began in what most people would call failure, which reminds me to state again that every defeat teaches a needed lesson to those who are ready and willing to be taught. When I entered law school, it was with the firm belief that I would emerge doubly prepared to catch up with the end of the rainbow and claim my pot of gold. For I still had no other conception of success except that of money and power. I attended law school at night and worked as an automobile salesman during the day. My sales experience in the lumber business was turned to good advantage. I prospered rapidly, doing so well, still performing more service and better service than that for which I was paid, that the opportunity came to enter the automobile manufacturing business. I saw the need for trained automobile mechanics, therefore, I opened an educational department in the manufacturing plant and began to train ordinary machinists in automobile assembly and repair work. The school prospered, paying me over $1,000 a month in net profits. Again, I was beginning to near the end of the rainbow. Again, I knew I had at last found my niche, and nothing could swerve me from my course or divert my attention, this time from the automobile business. My banker knew that I was prospering. Therefore, he loaned me money with which to expand. A peculiar trait of bankers, a trait which may be more or less developed in the rest of us too, is that they will loan us money without any hesitation when we are prosperous. My banker loaned me money until I was hopelessly in his debt. Then he took over my business as calmly as if it had belonged to him, which it did. From the station of a man of affairs who enjoyed an income of more than $1,000 a month, I was suddenly reduced to poverty. From the editors. As has been noted in previous volumes, according to one calculation source, the value of $1 in salary at the beginning of the 20th century was the equivalency of approximately $10 at the beginning of the 21st century. Using that comparison, the $1,000 Napoleon Hill was earning then would have been equal to about $10,000 a month today. But, as was also noted in Volume 3, there are many factors and variables in making direct dollar comparisons when it comes to salaries, and the conversion figures also vary among sources. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it took $17.89 in 2002 to buy what $1 bought in 1913. If the $17.89 figure were used relative to salaries, that would translate to Hill's annual salary being the equivalent of $214,680. That calculation, however, is based on all goods and services purchased by urban households, and, as we've seen during recessions, the fact that consumers spend less freely doesn't mean salaries are suddenly decreased accordingly, nor do salaries increase to match the freer spending in a particularly good economic climate. Back to Napoleon Hill's original text. Now, 20 years later, I thank the hand of fate for this forced change. But at that time, I looked upon the change as nothing but failure. The rainbow's end had disappeared, and with it, that proverbial pot of gold. It was many years later that I learned the truth that this temporary defeat was probably the greatest single blessing that ever came my way, because it forced me out of a business that in no way helped me to develop knowledge of self or of others, and it steered my efforts in a direction that brought me the rich experience I needed. For the first time, I began to ask myself if it were not possible for one to find something of value other than money and power at the rainbow's end. This temporary questioning did not amount to open rebellion, mind you, nor did I follow it far enough to get the answer. It merely came as a fleeting thought, as do so many other thoughts to which we pay no attention, and then passed out of my mind. Had I known as much then as I know now about the law of compensation, and had I been able to interpret experiences as I can now interpret them, I would have recognized that event as a gentle nudge from the hand of fate. But after putting up the hardest fight of my life up to that time, I accepted my temporary defeat as failure, and thus was ushered into my next and fourth turning point. It gave me an opportunity to put into use the knowledge of law that I had acquired. Fourth turning point. Because my wife's family had influence, I secured the appointment as assistant to the chief counsel for one of the largest coal companies in the world. My salary was greatly out of proportion to what was usually paid to beginners, and still further out of proportion to what I was worth. But pull was pull, and I was there just the same. It happened that what I lacked in legal skill, I more than made up by performing more service than that for which I was paid, and by taking the initiative and doing what needed to be done without being told to do it. I was holding my position without difficulty. I practically had a soft berth for life had I cared to keep it. Then, without consultation with my friends and without warning, I resigned. This was the first turning point that was of my own selection. It was not forced upon me. I saw the old man fate coming and beat him to the door. When pressed for a reason for resigning, I gave what seemed to me to be a very sound one, but I had trouble convincing the family circle that I had acted wisely. I quit that position because the work was too easy and I was performing it with too little effort. I saw myself drifting into the habit of inertia. I felt myself becoming accustomed to taking life easy, and I knew that the next step would be retrogression. I had so many friends at court that there was no particular motivation for me to keep moving. I was among friends and relatives, and I had a position that I could keep for as long as I wished, without exerting myself. I received an income that provided me with all the necessities and some of the luxuries, including a car and enough gasoline to keep it running. What more did I need? Nothing, I was beginning to say to myself. This was the attitude toward which I felt myself slipping. It was an attitude that, for some reason still unknown to me, startled me so sharply that I made what many believed to be an irrational move by resigning. However ignorant I might have been in other matters at that time, I have felt thankful ever since for having had sense enough to realize that strength and growth come only through continuous effort and struggle, that disuse brings atrophy and decay. This move proved to be the next most important turning point of my life, although it was followed by 10 years of effort that brought almost every conceivable grief the human heart can experience. I quit my job in the legal field, where I was getting along well, living among friends and relatives, and where I had what they believed to be an unusually bright and promising future ahead of me. I am frank to admit that it has been an ever-increasing source of wonderment to me as to why and how I gathered the courage to make the move that I did. As far as I am able to interpret it, I arrived at my decision to resign more because of a hunch or sort of prompting, which I did not understand at the time, than by logical reasoning. I selected Chicago as my new field of endeavor. I did this because I believe Chicago to be a place where one might find out if they had those sterner qualities that are so essential for survival in a world of keen competition. I made up my mind that if I could gain recognition in Chicago in any honorable sort of work, it would prove that I had something that might be developed into real ability. That was an odd process of reasoning. At least it was an unusual process for me to indulge in at that time, which reminds me to say that we human beings often give ourselves credit to which we are not entitled. I fear we too often assume credit for wisdom and for results that accrue from causes over which we have absolutely no control. I do not mean to convey the impression that I believe all of our acts to be controlled by causes beyond our power to direct, but I strongly urge you to study and correctly interpret those causes that mark the most vital turning points of your life. The points at which your efforts are diverted, from the old into new channels, in spite of what you might do. At least refrain from accepting any defeat as failure, until you have had time to analyze the final result. My first position in Chicago was that of advertising manager for a large correspondence school. I knew little about advertising, but my previous experience as a salesman, plus the advantage gained by rendering more service than that for which I was paid, enabled me to do particularly well. The first year I earned $5,200. I was coming back by leaps and bounds, and gradually I again began to see the shining pot of gold almost within my reach. History is full of evidence that a feast usually precedes a famine. I was enjoying a feast, but did not anticipate the famine that was to follow. I was getting along so well that I thoroughly approved of myself. Self-approval is a dangerous state of mind. This is a great truth which many people do not learn for the better part of a lifetime. Some never do learn it. But those who do are those who finally begin to understand the strange language of defeat. I am convinced that one has but few, if any, more dangerous enemies to combat than that of self-approval. Personally, I fear it more than defeat. This brings me to my fifth turning point, which was also of my own choice. Fifth turning point. I had done so well as advertising manager of the correspondence school that the president of the school induced me to resign my position and go into the candy manufacturing business with him. We organized the Betsy Ross Candy Company, and I became its first president. The business grew rapidly, and soon we had a chain of stores in 18 different cities. Again, I saw my rainbow's end almost within reach, and again, I believed I had at last found the business in which I wished to remain for life. The candy business was profitable, and because I looked upon money as being the only evidence of success, I naturally believed I was about to corner that success. Everything went smoothly until my business associate and a third man, whom we had taken into the business, took a notion to gain control of my interest in the business without paying for it. Their plan was successful, in a way, although I resisted more than they had anticipated I would. Therefore, for the purpose of gentle persuasion, they had me arrested on a false charge and then offered to withdraw the charge on condition that I turn over to them my interest in the business. I began to learn, for the first time, that there was much cruelty and injustice and dishonesty in the hearts of men. When the time for a preliminary hearing came, the complaining witnesses were nowhere to be found. But I had them brought and forced them to go on the witness stand to tell their stories. This resulted in my vindication and a damage suit against the perpetrators of the injustice. The incident brought about an irreparable breach between my business associates and myself, which finally cost me my interest in the business. But that was slight when compared with what it cost my associates, for they are still paying, and no doubt will continue to pay as long as they live. My damage suit was brought under what is known as a tort action, through which damages were claimed for malicious damage to character. In Illinois, where the case was filed, judgment under a tort action gives the one in favor of whom the judgment is rendered the right to have the person against whom it is obtained placed in jail until the amount of the judgment has been paid. In due time, I got a heavy judgment against my former business associates, and I could then have had both of them placed behind bars. For the first time in my life, I was brought face to face with the opportunity to strike back at my enemies in a manner that would hurt. I had in my possession a weapon with teeth in it, a weapon placed there by the enemies themselves. A strange feeling swept over me. Would I have my enemies jailed, or would I take advantage of this opportunity to extend them mercy, thereby proving myself to be made of different material? Then and there was laid in my heart the foundation upon which the 16th lesson of this course is built. For I made up my mind to permit my enemies to go free as they could be made, by my having extended them mercy and forgiveness. But long before my decision had been reached, the hand of fate had begun to deal roughly with these misguided men who had tried in vain to destroy me. Time, the master worker to which we must all submit sooner or later, had already been at work on my former business associates, and it had dealt with them less mercifully than I had done. One of them was later sentenced to a long term in the penitentiary for another crime that he had committed against some other person, and the other one had meanwhile been reduced to poverty. We can circumvent the laws in the statute books, but we can never circumvent the law of compensation. The judgment that I obtained against these three men stands on the records of the Superior Court of Chicago as silent evidence of vindication of my character. But it serves me in a more important way than that. It serves as a reminder that I could forgive enemies who had tried to destroy me, and for this reason, instead of destroying my character, I suspect that the incident served to strengthen it. Being arrested seemed, at the time, a terrible disgrace, even though the charge was false. It was not a pleasant experience, and I would not wish to go through a similar experience again, but I must admit that it was worth all the grief it cost me, because it gave me the opportunity to find out that revenge was not a part of my makeup. If you closely and carefully analyze the events described in this lesson, you can see how this entire course has been evolved from these experiences. Each temporary defeat left its mark on my heart and provided some part of the material of which this course has been built. We would not fear or run from trying experiences if we observed, from the biographies of men of destiny, that nearly every one of them was sorely put through the mill of merciless experience before he arrived. This leads me to wonder if the hand of fate does not test our fortitude in various and sundry ways before placing great responsibilities on our shoulders. It is significant to note that each turning point carried me nearer and nearer my rainbow's end, and brought me some useful knowledge that would later become a permanent part of my philosophy of life. Sixth turning point. We come now to the turning point that probably brought me nearer that rainbow's end than any of the others had, because it brought me to where I found it necessary to use all the knowledge I had acquired up to that time about practically every subject with which I was acquainted, and it gave me an opportunity for self-expression and development that rarely comes to a person so early in life. This turning point came shortly after my dreams of success in the candy business had been shattered, when I turned my efforts to teaching, advertising, and salesmanship as a department of one of the colleges in the Midwest. Some wise philosopher has said that we never learn very much about a given subject until we begin teaching it to others. My first experience as a teacher proved this to be true. My school prospered from the very beginning. I had a resident class and also a correspondence school through which I was teaching students in nearly every English-speaking country. Despite the ravages of war, the school was growing rapidly, and I once again saw the end of the rainbow within sight. Then came the second military draft, and it practically destroyed my school, as it caught most of those who were enrolled as students. At one stroke, I charged off more than $75,000 in tuition fees, and at the same time, contributed my own service to my country. Once more, I was penniless. Unfortunate is the person who has never had the thrill of being penniless at one time or another, for, as Edward Bach has truthfully stated, poverty is the richest experience that can come to a person, an experience which, however, he advises one to get away from as quickly as possible. Editor's Comment. Napoleon Hill knew something of the value of poverty from his own modest upbringing in the backwoods of Virginia. Edward Bach, whose writing on the subject is excerpted in Volume 2, also wrote from personal experience. And this same sentiment was expressed to Hill by Andrew Carnegie at their first meeting in 1908. In telling Hill that his own humble beginnings had been his inspiration to reach seemingly impossible goals, Carnegie also said, "The richest heritage a young man can have is to be born into poverty." This story is told in greater detail in the book A Lifetime of Riches, the biography of Napoleon Hill by Michael J. Ritt Jr. and Kirk Landers. Ritt worked as Hill's assistant for 10 years and was the first employee of the Napoleon Hill Foundation, where he served as executive director, secretary, and treasurer. The material in his book comes from his own personal knowledge of Hill, as well as from Hill's unpublished autobiography. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Again, I was forced to redirect my efforts. But before I proceed to describe the next and last important turning point, I should mention that no single event described up to this point is in itself of any practical significance. The 6 turning points that I have briefly described meant nothing to me taken singly, and they will mean nothing to you if analyzed singly. But take these events collectively, and they form a very significant foundation for the next turning point. They constitute reliable evidence that we human beings are constantly undergoing evolutionary changes as a result of the experiences of our lives, even though no single experience may seem to convey a definite, usable lesson. I must make this clear here, because my story has now reached the point at which people either go down in permanent defeat, or they rise with renewed energies to heights of attainment of stupendous proportions, according to the way in which they interpret their past experiences and use those experiences as the basis of future plans. If my story stopped here, it would be of no value to you, but there is another and more significant passage yet to be written. It must have been obvious to you, all through my description of the 6 turning points already outlined, that I had not really found my place in the world. It must have been obvious, too, that most, if not all, of my temporary defeats were due mainly to the fact that I had not yet truly discovered the work into which I could throw my heart and soul. Finding the work that one likes best and for which one is best fitted is very much like finding the person whom one loves best. There is no rule by which to make the search, but when the right niche is found, one immediately recognizes it. 7th Turning Point. To describe the 7th and last of the turning points of my life, I must go back to November 11, 1918, Armistice Day, the end of the World War. The war had left me without a penny, as I have already said, but I was happy to know that the slaughter had ceased and reason was about to reclaim civilization. As I stood in front of my office window and looked out at the howling mob that was celebrating the end of the war, my mind went back to my yesterdays, especially to a day when a kind old gentleman had laid his hand on my shoulder and told me that if I would acquire an education, I could make my mark in the world. I had been acquiring that education without knowing it. Over a period of more than 20 years, I had been going to school at the University of Hard Knocks, as you must have observed from my description of my various turning points. As I stood in front of that window, my entire past, with its bitter and its sweet, its ups and its downs, passed before me in review. The time had come for another turning point. I sat down at my typewriter, and, to my astonishment, my hands began to play a tune on the keyboard. I had never written so rapidly or so easily before. I did not plan or think about what I was writing. I just wrote whatever came into my mind. Unconsciously, I was laying the foundation for the most important turning point of my life. For when I finished, I had prepared a document through which I would finance a national magazine that would give me contact with people throughout the English-speaking world. So greatly did that document influence my own career and the lives of tens of thousands of other people that I believe it will be of interest to the students of this course. Therefore, I am reproducing it just as it appeared in Hill's Golden Rule magazine, where it was first published. A personal visit with your editor. I am writing on Monday, November 11th, 1918. Today will go down in history as the greatest holiday. On the street, just outside of my office window, the surging crowds of people are celebrating the downfall of an influence that has menaced civilization for the past 4 years. The war is over. Soon our boys will be coming back home from the battlefields of France. The lord and master of brute force is nothing but a shadowy ghost of the past. 2,000 years ago, the Son of Man was an outcast, with no place of abode. Now, the situation has been reversed, and the devil has no place to lay his head. Let each of us take unto himself the great lesson that this world war has taught, namely, only that which is based upon justice and mercy toward all, the weak and the strong, the rich and the poor alike, can survive. All else must pass on. Out of this war will come a new idealism, an idealism that will guide us not to see how much we can do our fellow man for, but how much we can do for him that will ameliorate his hardships and make him happier as he tarries by the wayside of life. Emerson embodied this idealism in his great essay, Compensation. Another great philosopher embodied it in these words, "Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." The time for practicing the golden rule philosophy is upon us. In business, as well as in social relationships, he who neglects or refuses to use this philosophy as the basis of his dealings will but hasten the time of his failure. And while I am intoxicated with the glorious news of the war's ending, is it not fitting that I should attempt to do something to help preserve for the generations yet to come one of the great lessons to be learned from William Hohenzollern's effort to rule the earth by force? I can best do this by going back 22 years for my beginning. Come with me, won't you? It was a bleak November morning, probably not far from the 11th of the month, that I got my first job as a laborer in the coal mine regions of Virginia at wages of $1 a day. $1 a day was a big sum in those days, especially to a boy of my age. Of this, I paid 50 cents a day for my room and board. Shortly after I began work, the miners became dissatisfied and commenced talking about striking. I listened eagerly to all that was said. I was especially interested in the organizer who had organized the union. He was one of the smoothest speakers I had ever heard, and his words fascinated me. He said one thing in particular that I have never forgotten, and if I knew where to find him, I would look him up today and thank him warmly for saying it. The philosophy which I gathered from his words has had a most profound and enduring influence upon me. Perhaps you will say that most labor agitators are not very sound philosophers, and I would agree with you if you said so. Maybe this one was not a sound philosopher, but surely the philosophy he expounded on this occasion was sound. Standing on a dry goods box in the corner of an old shop where he was holding a meeting, he said, "Men, we are talking about striking. Before you vote, I wish to call your attention to something that will benefit you if you will heed what I say. You want more money for your work, and I wish to see you get it, because I believe you deserve it. May I not tell you how to get more money and still retain the goodwill of the owner of this mine? We can call a strike and probably force them to pay more money, but we cannot force them to do this and like it. Before we call a strike, let us be fair with the owner of the mine and with ourselves. Let us go to the owner and ask him if he will divide the profits of his mine with us fairly. If he says yes, as he probably will, then let us ask him how much he made last month, and if he will divide among us a fair proportion of any additional profits he may make if we all jump in and help him earn more next month. He, being human like each of us, will no doubt say, 'Why, certainly, boys, go to it, and I'll divide it with you.' It is but natural that he would say that. After he agrees to the plan, as I believe he will if we make him see that we are in earnest, I want every one of you to come to work with a smile on your face for the next 30 days. I want to hear you whistling a tune as you go into the mines. I want you to go at your work with the feeling that you are one of the partners in this business. Without hurting yourself, you can do almost twice as much work as you are doing, and if you do more work, you are sure to help the owner of this mine make more money. And if he makes more money, he will be glad to divide a part of it with you. He will do this for sound business reasons, if not out of a spirit of fair play. If he doesn't, I'll be personally responsible to you, and if you say so, I'll help blow this mine into smithereens. That's how much I think of the plan, boys. Are you with me? They were, to the man. The following month, every man in the mines received a bonus of 20% of his month's earnings. Every month thereafter, each man received a bright red envelope with his part of the extra earnings in it. On the outside of the envelope were these printed words: "Your part of the profits from the work which you did that you were not paid to do." I have gone through some pretty tough experiences since those days of 20-odd years ago, but I have always come out on top, a little wiser, a little happier, and a little better prepared to be of service to my fellow men, owing to my having applied the principle of performing more work than I was actually paid to perform. It may be of interest to you to know that the last position I held in the coal business was that of assistant to the chief counsel for one of the largest companies in the world. It is a considerable jump from the position of common laborer in the coal mines to that of assistant to the chief counsel, a jump that I never could have made without the aid of this principle of performing more work than I was paid to perform. I wish I had the space in which to tell you of the scores of times that this idea of performing more work than I was paid to perform has helped me over rough spots. Many have been the times that I have placed an employer so deeply in my debt through the aid of this principle that I got whatever I asked for without hesitation or quibbling, without complaint or hard feelings, and what is more important, without the feeling that I was taking unfair advantage of my employer. I believe most earnestly that anything a man acquires from his fellow man, without the full consent of the one from whom it is acquired, will eventually burn a hole in his pocket, or blister the palms of his hands, to say nothing of gnawing at his conscience until his heart aches with regret. As I said in the beginning, I am writing on the morning of the 11th of November, while the crowds are celebrating the great victory. Therefore, it is but natural that I should turn to the silence of my heart for some thought to pass on to the world today, some thought that will help keep alive in the minds of Americans the spirit of idealism for which they have fought and in which they entered the World War. I find nothing more appropriate than the philosophy which I have related. To get this philosophy into the hearts of those who need it, I shall publish a magazine to be called Hill's Golden Rule. It takes money to publish national magazines, and I haven't very much of it at this writing. But before another month shall have passed, through the aid of the philosophy that I have tried to emphasize here, I shall find someone who will supply the necessary money and make it possible for me to pass on to the world the simple philosophy that lifted me out of the dirty coal mines and gave me a place where I can be of service to humanity. The philosophy which will raise you, my dear reader, whoever you may be and whatever you may be doing, into whatever position in life you may make up your mind to attain. Every person has, or ought to have, the inherent desire to own something of monetary value. In at least a vague sort of way, every person who works for others, and this includes practically all of us, looks forward to the time when he will have some sort of business or a profession of his own. The best way to realize that ambition is to perform more work than one is paid to perform. You can get along with but little schooling. You can get along with but little capital. You can overcome almost any obstacle with which you are confronted if you are honestly and earnestly willing to do the best work of which you are capable, regardless of the amount of money you receive for it. It was in this somewhat dramatic manner that a desire which had lain dormant in my mind for nearly 20 years became translated into reality. During all that time, I had wanted to become the editor of a newspaper. Back more than 30 years ago, when I was a very small boy, I used to kick the press for my father when he was publishing a small weekly newspaper, and I grew to love the smell of printer's ink. Perhaps this desire was subconsciously gaining momentum during all those years that I was going through the experiences outlined in these turning points of my life, until it finally burst forth in terms of action. Or it may be that there was another plan, over which I had no control, that urged me on and on, never giving me any rest in any other line of work until I began the publication of my first magazine. But the important thing is that I found my proper niche. Editor's Commentary. Referring again to Michael Ritt's A Lifetime of Riches, the biography of Napoleon Hill, and, as we also noted in Volume 3, Hill took the foregoing post-war essay to George B. Williams, a Chicago printer he had met while working at the White House, and by early January of 1919, Hill's Golden Rule magazine was on the newsstands. The first issue was 48 pages. In the beginning, with no money to pay anyone else, Hill wrote and edited every word himself, changing his writing style for each article as well as using a variety of pen names. Additional staff was hired later, which soon led to problems on the inside and on the outside, and Williams attempted to buy out Hill's share of the business. But when Hill realized that one stipulation of the buyout prevented him from any involvement in a competing publication, in October of 1920, he simply left. By April of 1921, he had raised the money for a new publication, Napoleon Hill's Magazine, the foundation of which was again the Golden Rule. But it also expanded into presenting many of the principles of success that would become the basis of Hill's later books. The magazine's acceptance and success also led to Hill's success as a speaker and motivator, which led to even greater success for the magazine. At the same time, Napoleon Hill was working with one of the inmates of a penitentiary to develop a correspondence course which he took to the prisons to encourage prisoner rehabilitation. Most everything Hill did during this time was successful, and the success of the prison program was significant. But the greed of two members of the board of directors, one of which was the prison chaplain, eventually led in 1923 to the demise of not only the educational rehabilitation programs, but also the magazine and numerous other successful offshoot ventures. The bleak irony, as Michael Ritt notes, was that few enterprises in the 1920s could have been more idealistic or humanitarian in concept. Yet, in seeking to stir goodness in men's souls, these enterprises had stirred mean-spirited men to a bloodlust that destroyed everything. As devastated as he was, Hill blamed himself and his own poor judgment of the character of others. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Strangely enough, I entered into this work with never a thought of looking for either the end of the rainbow or the proverbial pot of gold. For the first time in my life, I seemed to realize, without a doubt, that there was something else to be sought in life that was worth more than gold. I went at my editorial work with but one main thought in mind, to render the world the best service of which I was capable, whether my efforts brought me a penny in return or not. The publication of Hill's Golden Rule magazine brought me in contact with thinking people all over the country. It was my big chance to be heard. My message of optimism and goodwill toward others became so popular that I was invited to go on a countrywide speaking tour during the early part of 1920, during which I had the privilege of meeting and talking with some of the most progressive thinkers of this generation. Contact with these people went a very long way toward giving me the courage to keep on doing the good work that I had started. This tour was a liberal education in itself, because it brought me in exceedingly close contact with people in practically all walks of life. One day during my speaking tour, I was sitting in a restaurant in Dallas, Texas, watching the hardest downpour of rain that I have ever seen. The water was pouring down over the plate glass window in two great streams, and playing backward and forward from one of the streams to the other were little streams, creating what resembled a great ladder of water. As I looked at this unusual scene, the thought flashed into my mind that I would have a splendid lecture if I organized all that I had learned from the seven turning points of my life and all I had learned from studying the lives of successful men, and offered it under the title of The Magic Ladder to Success. From the editors. For anyone who may be listening to this volume of The Law of Success before hearing the previous volume, and who may not have heard the editor's note at the beginning of this one, we will repeat an explanatory portion of a commentary from Volume 3 so that you will better understand what Napoleon Hill means by studying the lives of successful men. The source of this information is, again, A Lifetime of Riches. In 1908, during a particularly down time in the U.S. economy, and with no money and no work, Hill took a job with Bob Taylor's magazine. Although it would not provide much in the way of income, it would provide the opportunity to meet and profile the giants of industry and business, the first of whom was the creator of America's steel industry, multimillionaire Andrew Carnegie, who was to become Hill's mentor. Carnegie was so impressed by Hill's perceptive mind that following their three-hour interview, he invited Hill to spend the weekend at his estate. After two more days of conversation, Carnegie told Hill that he believed any person could achieve greatness if they understood the philosophy of success and the steps required to achieve it, and that this knowledge could be gained by interviewing those who had achieved greatness and then compiling the information and research into a comprehensive set of principles. He believed it would take at least 20 years. For no more compensation than that, Carnegie would make the necessary introductions and cover travel expenses. It took Hill 29 seconds to accept Carnegie's proposal. Carnegie told him afterward that, had it taken him more than 60 seconds to make the decision, he would have withdrawn the offer, for a man who cannot reach a decision promptly, once he has all the necessary facts, cannot be depended upon to carry through any decision he may make. It was through Hill's unwavering dedication that this book and his others were eventually written. Hill's conversations with Andrew Carnegie during their first meeting would later also become the basis for Think and Grow Rich. On the back of an envelope, I outlined the 15 points out of which this lecture would be built, and I later worked these points into a lecture that was literally built from the temporary defeats described in the 7 turning points of my life. The material out of which my knowledge was gathered is nothing more or less than the knowledge that was forced upon me through experiences that have undoubtedly been considered by some to be failures. This course is but the sum total of that which I gathered through these failures. If the course proves to be of value to you, as I hope it will, you may give credit to the failures described in this lesson. Perhaps you will want to know what material, monetary benefits I have gained from these turning points. All right, I'll tell you. To begin with, the estimated income from the sale of this course is all that I need, despite the fact that I have insisted my publishers apply the Ford philosophy and sell the course at a popular price that is within the reach of all who want it. In addition to the income from the sale of the course, I am now engaged in writing a series of illustrated editorials that is to be syndicated and published in the newspapers of the country. These editorials are based upon the same 15 points as outlined in this course. Editor's comment. Again, for those who may have missed the note at the beginning of this volume, originally the law of success was indeed based on 15 laws. The law of the mastermind was initially considered to be just an introductory lesson, then later became the first law, and all the others moved down one. Later still, the universal law of cosmic habit force was added, for a total of 17 laws or principles. Back to the original text. The estimated net income from the sale of the editorials is more than enough to care for my needs. I am now also working in collaboration with a group of scientists, psychologists, and businessmen in writing a postgraduate course that will soon be available to all students who have mastered this more elementary Law of Success course, covering not only the 15 laws here outlined from a more advanced viewpoint, but also including still other laws which have but recently been discovered. Editor's Commentary. In the latter part of 1929, as a result of the October 29th stock market crash, book sales of The Law of Success declined dramatically. Napoleon Hill, ever the optimist, did not take the crash as seriously as others did. He thought that the economy would recover quickly, and he went to work turning his Magic Ladder to Success lecture series into another book. He also organized the lectures to become a class. But in 1930, when The Magic Ladder to Success was published, books were not a luxury that many people could afford, and few had any immediate hope for the opportunities the book proposed. With the book failing to sell, Hill realized that reports of the severe economic conditions had not been greatly exaggerated at all. At this same time, many of the newspapers that had been expected to become part of Hill's syndication deal were having their own financial difficulties, and there was little to be made from this once promising venture either. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. I have included this information only because I know how common it is for all of us to measure success in terms of dollars and to refuse as unsound all philosophy that does not affect a good bank balance. For most of my life, I have been poor, exceedingly poor, as far as bank balances were concerned. This has been very largely a matter of choice, because I have been putting the best of my time into the toilsome job of gathering some much-needed knowledge of life. From the experiences described in my 7 turning points, I have gathered a few golden threads of knowledge that I could have gained in no other way than through defeat. My own experiences have led me to believe that the language of defeat is the plainest and most effective language in the world once one begins to understand it. I am almost tempted to say that I believe it to be the language in which nature cries out to us when we will listen to no other language. I am glad that I have experienced much defeat. It has had the effect of tempering me with the courage to undertake tasks that I would never have begun had I been surrounded by protecting influences. Defeat is a destructive force only when it is accepted as failure. When accepted as teaching some needed lesson, it is always a blessing. Editor's comment. A defeat to which Napoleon Hill does not refer in this book, but which Michael Ritt mentions in A Lifetime of Riches, was another shocking loss that he suffered in 1923. Returning to Chicago after the significant loss of his first magazine and subsequent businesses, Hill found that the building in which he kept some of his most treasured documents had been completely destroyed by a fire. Among the losses were numerous letters from Woodrow Wilson, as well as an endorsement of Hill's proposal that Wilson had used to sell war bonds, and a letter from President Taft endorsing Hill to potential employers. But most stunning was the loss of Napoleon Hill's entire collection of confidential questionnaires that had been completed by the most successful people of the day, the people he met through the introductions made by Andrew Carnegie. Those questionnaires had represented Hill's 15 years of research, to that time, on the philosophy of success. As with all of his adversities and defeats, Napoleon recovered and carried on, proving once again and without question that his lessons to others are truly based on experience.